Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, an amazing story of survival and Thanksgiving with our guest Gary Ettinger, a logger, backwoodsman, champion sled dog racer, philosopher, and author. His book, Will to Live, A Saga of Survival, details the events of February 15, 2007, when Gary was logging alone in the deep woods, sub-zero temperatures, and an accident sent a tree falling the wrong way. The tree completely sheared off Gary Ettinger's leg below the knee, and using a strength of will that few people possess, he was able to crawl first to his logging skidder, then to his truck, and then drive to the open road where rescuers arrived in the nick of time. Gary's life leading up to the accident gave him the mental and physical stamina to survive that day. He was born poor in the deep woods of Price County, in a family that often didn't have enough money for things most of us would consider essential. As a young boy, he set traps and traveled by snowshoe for hours in the woods. He went to a one-room schoolhouse, survived a boating accident at the age of 6, lost his mother at the age of 18, became a champion sled dog racer, operated a fishing camp in the Yukon wilderness, and backpacked as a big game hunter in the mountains of Montana. Now, through it all, Gary Ettinger maintained a sense of who he was, where he belonged, and the importance of wilderness and the natural order for human existence. If you'd like to talk to Gary, please give us a call. Our lines are wide open, toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Gary, that's quite a book and quite a story.
Well, thank you. You know, thanks for having me on, Glenn. I kind of checked around, and I found out it's a real honor to be invited onto your program.
Oh, it's not that much of an honor, but it's an honor to have you here with me. Let's cut right to the chase because we've got so much that I want to talk about. I want to get right into it. Tell us what happened that cold morning. It was 40 below zero on February 15th, 2007.
Well, you know, I'm not normal in that I can be pretty stubborn, and it, I should have stayed home that day because it was so cold, but I was cutting another tree down, and there was two of them growing right together. They were both soft maple, and normally in the wintertime they're frozen together. You just cut them as one tree and they fall down, and I made a miscalculation that one big tree was leaning harder than I thought it should be, and as I was cutting it off the stump, it started to barber chair, meaning it started to split vertically up the trunk. And so I took off running because that's always bad. And a bunch of things just happened to come together perfectly. I made it 7 feet away from the accident, mm-hmm. from the tree there. And my left leg was just clearing another stump that I had cut just before. And the butt of that tree kicked back, and then it kicked sideways. And when it came down, it must have just missed me, my body, but it came down right on the edge of that stump where my leg was trying to clear, and it sheared it right off.
What happened next? What do you do? What goes through your mind when something like that happens to you? Here you're out in the middle of the woods by yourself, no cell phone with you. It was in your truck, correct?
Right.
What did you do next?
Well, it hits you so hard, there's no pain right away. It's just a great big jolt through your whole system. I didn't have any idea what had happened. I ended up sitting astraddle that tree I'd just cut before, and my first thought was to touch my chest. I think subconsciously I thought I was dead. And so I touched my chest with my right hand, and it was solid. I could feel it. And I thought to myself, oh, you're all right. And so then I went to stand up, and my left leg didn't touch the ground, and I tried again real hard, and it still wasn't touching the ground. So as I was preparing my mind to expect a broken leg, as I brought my eyes around, instead I just saw steam rising off the end of my stump just below the knee. There was a stream of blood about the size of a pencil pouring down into the snow, and my boot twisted backwards and my foot sticking out of the top of my boot. For just the briefest of seconds, I knew I would never be perfect again. I mean, That's how I wrote it in the book, and that's just how it was. And then my mind went into denial. I mean, no, it can't be. I mean, wake up from this terrible dream. You know, we've all had these kind of nightmares, and you wake up and, oh, my wife is still alive. My kids are still alive. And so I don't know how long that lasted. If it was a couple seconds, if it was 15 seconds, I don't know. There was just, my head was spinning, and I just was trying to wake up. And then all of a sudden it just, you got to get going here. And that was the moment. That's when I accepted it. It's done.
You tried to make a tourniquet.
Yeah. Well, plan A, in the case of a bad chainsaw cut, was to grab my belt and use that as a tourniquet. So I slid down onto the snow, and my boot drug along because it was still attached by shreds of clothing, and put that around my leg just above the knee and give it a good reef, and my belt broke because it was an old belt and I had lots of adrenaline going.
Your belt broke so you can't make a tourniquet? What did you do next?
Well, I had to stop my life from leaking out the bottom of my leg, so I tied it back together.
Tied the belt back together.
Right. And it slipped out the first time. The second time, I made sure I hung on to the ends. I tied a square knot, and my fingers weren't working very good anymore because it was still like 15 below. I got it tight, put it around my leg again, gave it a good reef, and jerked it right off the buckle that time.
So there you are. Your belt is of no use. You can't build a tourniquet. Your life is seeping away. You figured, how much time did you think you had at that point in time?
Well, I guess based on trailing mortally wounded deer, just a quick snap figure, I had 30 minutes before I'd bleed to death. I didn't know how long before I passed out, but 30 minutes just flashed in my head. And where I was, getting out of there, I just didn't think it was possible.
What did you do next?
Well, for a few seconds, I quit. I said, the heck with it. Just lay back and get cold. It was the panic and the pain was starting to come now. And it's funny. When I quit fighting, it just, everything went away. You know, the pain went away, the panic went away. And I saw a darkness. And I'm not sure if I was started to pass out or not. I don't know. But I just laid back on my elbows, and all of a sudden, this stupid idea just come out of the air. What the heck? Why don't you see how far you can get? And boy, I just latched onto that like a coon on a frog. You know, I just, man. And just like that, my fight came back, and unfortunately, the pain and the panic came back with it.
So the first thing you had to do was get to that logging skidder.
Yeah, I was just going to see how far I could get. I knew I could make better time up in the skidder than if I tried to crawl all the way out. I knew that was crazy. And so I just started crawling to the skidder. When I got there, it's hard skidder to get in and into for the loggers out there. It's a John Deere 440, and, you know, it's tough with...
Well, the door into the cab is elevated. So
no, this one don't have a door. It's just a real tight cab.
You had to get up.
Yep, the first step is above the knee. And then it's another pretty high step up to the running boards before you can get in. So, you know, I figured it out. I put my bad knee on the left side of the step and I grabbed my boot and hugged that to my chest so it wouldn't get tangled up in the brush. And then, I got my foot up alongside there and I slid off the first time. I didn't get my boot on there good enough and I smashed that stump up against the skidder and oh man, I hollered pretty loud, but the next time, I moved my knee a little bit more to the left and made sure I had enough room for my foot to get alongside there, and I could pull myself up with one arm and got up in there.
You were able to drive the skidder back to your pickup truck.
Yeah.
And then you had to get from the skidder to the truck.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had to stop short because where I come out to the logging road, I was on the blocking side of getting out of there, so I stopped. Before I got to my pickup, so crawled out of there and then crawled over to my pickup, probably 50 feet away. The pickup was real easy to get into, but that has a standard transmission.
How do you drive a clutch when you've only got one foot?
Well, you push the clutch in with your right foot, and then when I went to shove it into gear, my eyes caught the four-wheel drive shift lever, and I rammed it in the four-wheel low. And low range with that gear ratio, I don't think you'd kill the motor.
So you managed to get the truck going, and you're heading down this logging road trying to get back to Highway D. You were able to reach your cell phone, and you made a phone call on 911, and we've got a copy of that conversation. We're going to listen to it right now.
911, state your emergency. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Hi, Gary Ettinger. I cut my leg off. I need help.
Okay, where are you at?
I'm on Bill Hynek's land out in Emory. Off of 130. South of 130 off of Schwamigan Drive.
So take Z to Schwamigan Drive?
Go to Schwamigan Drive, south of 130, 3/4 mile.
Is your truck or anything on the roadway?
I'm trying to drive out now.
You're driving right now?
Real slow. My leg is completely cut off.
Where is your leg at?
It's in my goddamn boot.
Okay, and are you bleeding real bad?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, just 1 second.
I'm going to pass out.
Well, stop driving. Pull over to the side of the road. What kind of vehicle do you have?
It's a Toyota pickup.
What color?
Green.
Okay, pull over to the side of the road.
I ain't pulling over. I'm getting out of here.
Where are you going to go?
I'll be on D if I can get there.
Okay, just 1 second.
I don't have a second.
Hello, this is Ryan. Stay on the line with me, Gary.
Oh, God, it hurts.
You cut your leg with a saw?
No, a tree severed it right off.
Okay.
I mean this right off. It just sits in my goddamn boot.
Okay. How is it below the knee?
Yes.
Okay.
I couldn't get a tourniquet on it. My belt broke.
Okay.
I'm going to bleed to death. They don't hurry.
Okay, we've got them in order as quick as we can go. Duane's got the ambulance paged.
I can't get here fast enough, man.
I know, Gary. I know what you're saying. We'll get out there as fast as we possibly can, okay?
Oh, a stupid-ass mistake.
Okay.
Oh, God. If I don't make it, call my wife and family. I love them.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
It was a 911 call from Gary Ettinger after he severed his leg on the morning of February 15th, 2007, alone on a logging road in the woods of Price County. Gary, obviously, they arrived in time.
Yeah, they sure did. It turns out in the nick of time, there's lots of things I didn't know till a lot later, how close I was to dying that day.
Now, one of the last things you said on that call was to tell your wife, Leanne, that you loved her. It's just been one woman for you your whole life.
Yeah, actually it has. When we started dating, we never had a serious fight and never broke up. And, you know, it's been 30-some years now. If she was here, she'd tell you exactly how many years, but it's 30-some.
How did the paramedics manage to rescue you and get you patched up in time?
The paramedics in Price County at that time were not allowed to do IV injections yet. So they stopped first. Brian, the guy who was on the 911 call, Brian Roosh, he got there first. He's a deputy, and he put his belt around my leg and got the bleeding stopped.
Did what you tried to do.
Right. And then the ambulance crew got there maybe 5 minutes later. They cut my boot off, got my clothes off of the boot there, and then they wrapped it with gauze real tight, and then they just threw me in the ambulance and had it off. What helped keep me alive was that I wanted to pass out. I mean, I figured I was going to live now, and in a perfect world, I'd wake up in a hospital with my leg sewed back on. And I just wanted to escape reality so bad. And so I just relaxed every pore and just tried to slip away. And this guy, his name was Mike, he started pestering me, just something fierce. And, you know, come on, Gary, keep your eyes open, Gary. What's your wife's name? What's your kids' names? And I'd try to slip away, and then he'd start in again. And the third time he asked me how old I was, he said, "How old are you again?" 52, and I swore at him. And I said, "I just told you 2 minutes ago I was 55. And that gave me another shot of adrenaline. I mean, he was trying to make me mad, you know, and it worked. And then I realized, oh, man, I just swore at this guy. I wonder how he took it. And I looked up at him. He was up there grinning away.
Now, the Spirit of Marshfield arrived in time. You got a transfusion. How many units of blood did it take by the time they had you all patched up?
All together, I received 10 units of blood.
And how many does a human body normally have?
Probably 11 to 12, you know, right in there.
But you were running on empty.
Yeah, there's no way I could have lost 10 units. But I think I lost, if you look on the internet, it says 5 units is the most you can lose without dying. I think I was pushing that and then some that day.
You pushed it your whole life, haven't you?
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Now, after it was all over, you were visited by a psychiatrist, and you told him you didn't want to be considered a hero. What did he tell you?
Yeah, well, he said that I was. He said that hardly anybody could have done what I did. And long story short, you know, after I made it all the way out to my pickup, maybe out of 100 people, 3 or 4 would be standing there with me. That took a while to digest, but, you know, I was just being me. I mean, I had a real hard time understanding why everybody was so excited about this story. It just, Leanne that first morning come in and said, well, you're on the radio about your accident. And I said, you're kidding. It's just a dumb logger had an accident. So it was a real struggle for me to come to grips with all this.
Gary Ettinger, his book, Will to Live, A Saga of Survival, and as compelling and as riveting and as fascinating as that moment of his life was, well, his whole life has been that way. And we're going to explore that with him next. We'd like you to join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Gary Ettinger on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
Gary Ettinger is our guest. His book, Will to Live, A Saga of Survival. Gary, where can people pick up the book if they're looking for it?
Well, the easiest way to get a copy would be to go on my website, GaryEttinger.com, and email me, and I can tell you which store is the closest if you want, or I can mail you a copy if you tell me.
You want to give us the name of a couple of stores?
Well, right here in Wausau, it's Yonke Bookstore.
Okay.
Up in Medford, it's Shane's Outfitting, and in Prentice, Prentice Hardware, Phillips Homespun. In Park Falls, it'd be Park Falls Petro or Park Pharmacy.
We're going to go to the phones right now, 1-800-780-9742. If you want to talk to Gary Ettinger, we have Ken in Phillips on the line. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
Ken, you're on the radio with Gary Ettinger.
Okay. Hi, Gary. This is Ken.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to reaffirm that you're a hell of a guy, and I was out there that next year, as you recall, on the snowmobile. I heard we had land right next to you there, and I heard the chainsaw, and I said, oh, that must be Gary. He's at his peak of what he needs to do, what he wants to do, what he loves to do. So I just wanted to say congratulations, and I'm glad you're still with us, and we'll see you in a few weeks.
So, Ken, thanks so much for the phone call. We appreciate it. And Gary, as Ken said, you went right back out there and started logging again. A lot of people would have hung up that chainsaw after what you went through.
Yeah. If you would buy the book and you're reading through it, you're going to – I keep coming back to this thing called Ettinger Pride. And, you know, it took a while to understand, but why it was so important for me to go back in the woods. And the deal was – there's no way I could let the woods beat me. You know, that to not be able to go back to that job, you know, that meant that I was a coward, you know, and I couldn't handle that.
Your whole life has been a life of struggle and survival in the deep woods. Your family roots go way back in Price County.
Yeah, back to my great grandparents. They came to that area in 1903 in a covered wagon. They came up from Iowa. And we settled along the North Fork of the Jump River there. In fact, I owned the land my great-grandparents owned.
And you grew up in Kennan, which is in that area, and you still live there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great place to live. You know, and I'm sure all the old families, I'll call them old families out there listening, understand what it is to have roots in a place and be able to travel the same land that your ancestors did and relive those same stories. There's something about that that gives you a pride, you know, in yourself and in your family.
As a child, you lived without the luxuries that most of us grew up with. You write about sleeping under piles of coats on cold winter nights in order to keep warm. Many of the kids sleeping together in a single bed, the roof acting like a sieve during rainstorms, just sprouting holes and leaks all across that small house of yours. You only got ice cream on your birthday, and then it was homemade.
Yeah.
How did that kind of an existence mold your character?
Well, I can only guess, but I'm pretty sure that it makes you tougher. You know, I mean, there's a saying, if it don't kill you, it only makes you tougher. And so, you know, you're used to that stuff. You know, you can tolerate a little pain. It don't kill you. Pain don't kill you. It's other stuff that kills you.
Do you think too many of our kids, our teenagers, our high school kids growing up, you think they're too soft now?
Well, that's a tough question, but, you know, they've been raised like marshmallows. I'll grant you that. I think the human spirit is still there. I think if they had to do, you know, live like I did, they'd make it. You know, you don't lose that spirit in 50 or 100 years. And just think of the guys going off to war right now and what they're doing. They're just young kids. They're tough as nails, you know. So it's there. I don't know that it's noble to be raised like I was raised, but when you need it, it kind of comes in handy.
Gary Ettinger, he's got a new book out, and we're going to be talking about his life growing up in rural Price County and more when Route 51 continues. We are back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Gary Ettinger, a logger, backwoodsman, champion sled dog racer, philosopher, and author with a new book called Will to Live, A Saga of Survival. If you missed our first half hour, you missed the story of Gary surviving an incredible logging accident alone by himself in the North Woods of Phillips on an old logging road with a tree falling down, completely severing his leg. And he managed to claw his way literally out of those woods and survive. His whole life has been a matter of survival. He grew up in a poor family in rural Price County and had a series of rather amazing adventures. Many of them centering Gary around the wilderness, around hunting, trapping. And that outdoors life is something that really molded you as a person.
Yeah, I guess it did. You know, when you're out in the woods, you got to figure things out for yourself and rely on yourself. And when you make mistakes, you own them. And when you do things right, you own them. But, you know, I liked the woods. I was real comfortable. I felt safe in the woods. And it was in the towns where I didn't really care to be.
You were very close to your older brother, Larry. The two of you shared a lot, and you went hunting and trapping. Those experiences gave you an appreciation of the wilderness.
Yeah, and also, if I'm tough, I'm going to have to credit my brother Larry for doing it, because he was 10 years older than me. So when you're 10 and he's 20, you got to really go to keep up with somebody like that, and he would never cut you any slack. He always expected you to hold up your end of the bargain.
You tell a story of yourself at the age of 10 wearing snowshoes that were almost as big as you were at that time, keeping up with Larry, and the two of you went out setting traps for beavers many, many miles away from your home. You were gone all day. You didn't get back into the middle of the night. That's some kind of a life for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, you'd think I'd have wised up after that one, wouldn't you? But, you know, I don't know. I just liked being out there, and I liked going. And I liked being around Larry. You know, I suppose he was my hero as a kid. And it's just something I really liked to do. I enjoyed the challenge. I enjoyed overcoming those challenges. You know, and I figured out all these things that I've done, it's more mental than it is physical, you know.
At Larry's funeral, you write that you listened to the preacher drone on and on about things you didn't believe in, and you wanted to stand up and give one final hunting call to your brother.
Yeah, the Ettingers have this hunting call, and it's similar to when the Swiss people, you know, yodel back and forth. We imitate the hooting of a barred owl. Hoo, 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 hoo. And it means either where are you or come here. And this was invented way before all these nice little radios. But, yeah, I did. You know, it would have been a really good tribute for Larry. And, of course, I couldn't pull it off. I was choking up just thinking about it. But I'd wished I'd asked one of my cousins to do it. You know, our hunting gang is, it's just a family unit. And actually, that's what keeps our family together is this hunting tradition.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Gary Ettinger. Gary, why do you think it is that some people in this world can't live without wilderness? And most people don't seem to value it at all. We're completely tied up with our televisions, our internet, our Facebook pages, and our shopping malls.
Well, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I think people who love wilderness value it, for one thing, because we can get off to the side and we can look at our lives and at humanity and, you know, get a more realistic view of things. You know, when we're running around in the world we're in right now, you don't have time to do that. You know, there's never any quiet time to really sit and reflect about the important things in life, and your relationships with people and your relationships with the earth even. We live in an artificial world that we build around ourselves. And when you're in wilderness, you're in a real world where you realize you're not in control. You know, you're part of the landscape.
Gary, can you read a passage from your book for me? The passage where you're out in the woods by yourself and you come upon the spirit of your great grandfather.
Sure. I was down in the Big Woods, our traditional hunting country, a place my dad had first shown me. It was one of those soft evenings during deer season, one of those drop-dead quiet times. Not a breath of air was moving, complete and utter calm and stillness. The quiet is so loud you can actually hear it. Some say it's when you can hear the sound of blood rushing through your head. I say it's when you can hear the universe expanding, echoes from the Big Bang. So as darkness fell, I headed out, at peace with everything, wishing it would last a little longer. By the time I reached the flat along the river, it was pretty dark, dark enough that at a distance, if you looked straight at something, you couldn't make it out. You had to look to the side. As I rounded a bend in the trail, I could make out a manly form with his right shoulder leaning against a big white oak. He appeared to be waiting for me. I thought I was the only one down there that night. Only a relative would have been waiting for me in such a place, and no one was supposed to be there, and yet, here was someone waiting for me. Feeling a mixture of apprehension and wonderment, I drew near. The man straightened himself from the tree and recognition came as I made out the dark, wide mustache and wide-brimmed hat that he wore. From old photos I'd seen many times, it was my great-grandfather.
And what did your great-grandfather say to you?
He just said, "Let's go home."
Why do you think you met the spirit of your great-grandfather alone in those woods?
Well, I think I was able to meet him that night just because I was in that zone, in that quiet, wild place where I could tune into myself and tune into the natural rhythms of the earth and the heavens. And why he appeared to me, or why he wanted to appear to me that night, I guess, was because I think he wanted to validate the way I was doing things, the way I was conducting my life as a hunter, trying to keep the old ways alive. You know, not giving in to technology and all the gadgets that hunters are, you know, want to buy. And then meeting me along the river, that has been so important to our family. I mean, it was just a natural place. If he wanted to meet me, that was the place to do it.
As a young man growing up, the conservation wardens were kind of the enemy in your family, weren't they? You write that your family considered the deer season to be from July 4th to New Year's Eve.
Yeah, you know, I there was some research once, and I run across where that actually, I think that was a season at one time. I mean, a long time ago. And so when they changed it, they constricted it down. We just kept with the old way. But Yeah, you know what? By the 4th of July, the yearlings are big enough to be worthwhile to harvest, and they fattened up enough. And then usually by New Year's, they're starting to get skinny again. So, but, it, you know, it was just a way of putting food on the table. And it was a lot more fun than raising a steer. You know, you got to give them that.
So a lot of the people you grew up with were in this cat and mouse game. They were being chased by the wardens quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's just common in all the Northwoods people. I mean, it wasn't just my family. Lots of families did that. Mine hung on to it a little longer. We lived farthest from town, and maybe we liked hunting a lot more. But, you know, we stayed with the old ways pretty long.
Did you change your ways? You write in the book that your attitudes toward conservation and toward the role of the state in protecting wildlife evolved.
Yeah, they sure did. I mean, you know, as a kid, fish and game laws were there to make it harder to get something. And, you know, I finally wised up that they were there to protect the species so that we wouldn't hunt them to extinction. And in fairness to other hunters, you know, ready, set, go. You all get the same opportunity. And then the other thing is some of these rules and regulations are made to so we don't override the animal's gifts to escape, you know, to make it hunting and not killing.
Gary Ettinger, that book again is called Will to Live, A Saga of Survival. And you can pick it up in a number of places around north central Wisconsin. Gary, have you got any appearances coming up?
Well, we're going to be in some libraries here in December. Medford, we're going to be December 7th, starting at 4 o'clock at the Medford Library, in Park Falls on December 11th, starting at 10:30 in the morning, and then at Phillips, December 14th, starting at 5 o'clock in the evening.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how Gary became a champion sled dog racer and his life in the wilderness on the Yukon River on a fishing camp when Route 51 continues.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station. Thanks very much.
I'm Glenn Mobrick. My guest today, Gary Ettinger, who has a book called Will to Live, A Saga of Survival. We've talked about how he survived a terrible logging accident that probably would have killed you, me, and 99% of the people in this world alone, 40 degree below zero weather in the woods of Price County when a tree fell over and completely severed his leg. And what we're finding out is that it was Gary's life growing up in the woods of Price County and the experiences that he had as a backwoodsman, as somebody who appreciated wilderness and above all a tenacious attitude to push himself to the limit that helped him survive that incident. 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Gary, you became a champion sled dog racer. Tell us about some of the medals you won.
Oh, there's this organization called the International Sled Dog Racing Association, ISDRA, and I managed to win the gold, the silver, and the bronze different years. That would be like the all-around champion, where you earn points at every sanctioned race, and at the end, the points determine. And then I won just about every major race in North America. And in 1987, we won the World Championship out at Laconia, New Hampshire.
Now, there's a picture of you in the book with 18 racing dogs pulling your sled in Fairbanks. How did you get all of those dogs to think the same way at the same time?
Well, I guess it's an art. And to try to explain that on the radio, you know, we're talking 3 hours here. but first, the dogs, that's what they're bred to do. That's all they know. That's all they want to do.
And you had to breed dogs. You bred your own dogs.
Yeah, yeah. We had to do that the hard way, too. But it's the best way because you raise dogs and you know each other really well, right from puppies on. And so
you almost act like your dogs are human. You say you can look them in the eyes and you know what they're thinking.
Well, you're with them so much, you can. I mean, again, that was the art thing. That's just a little knack that I was born with and I can do. It was easy for me to do this, you know.
That was a dream of yours, but a dream that consumed all your time and energy. And if I can just read a couple of lines from your book. Looking back now, I don't know how Leanne and I managed to do it. I was putting in 50 to 60 hours a week driving pulp truck, and Leanne was working a normal 40-hour job. Somehow we squeezed in caring for and training a kennel that had now grown to around 100 animals, counting puppies and breeding stock. On top of that, we somehow managed to build our own log home on the back 40. Leanne has been with you the whole time, hasn't she?
Oh, man. I couldn't have done half of this without her. There's no way. And the miracle here is that, you know, she only weighs 100 pounds dripping wet. So, you know, I lucked into a really good woman, I tell you what.
How does she put up with you?
Well, I don't know. I guess the short answer, she must love me an awful lot to allow me to have done the things that I've done and stayed there with me. But, you know, it's been mutual.
Now, you eventually got burned out on the all-consuming nature of dog racing, and then you went to the Alaska wilderness to run a fish camp in the upper reaches of the Yukon River. It was just you in a subsistence shelter and a smokehouse that you built yourself and your fish wheel. Tell us about this fish wheel that you had to build.
Yeah, this fish wheel is just the neatest contraption you can imagine. It's just a big water wheel that's stationary, and water makes it spin. And there's baskets that spin in the water, and as the salmon are swimming upstream, it scoops them out of the water, and before they fall back in, you know, before the basket goes all the way over, they slide out a chute and fall into a box on the side. And then you come up there with your boat and throw them in your boat and take them up to market.
How many king salmon could you pull out of that river in one day using that fish wheel?
The kings were, they weren't real strong run, but a good day for kings was, say, 30. And they averaged, you know, a king averaged 25 pounds, and we got a buck and a half a pound.
That's a lot of fish, and that's a fairly good amount of money, too.
Yeah, you know, you worked for a month for nothing, trying to get ready, and then when the money came in, it came in pretty well.
That was really like the Wild West, wasn't it, according to your description in the book?
Well, yeah, you know, there's no law and order up there. I mean, if somebody wants to harass you or give you a lot of grief, you have to take care of yourself. There's nobody to call on the phone and say, help. You know, Fairbanks was an hour and a half away.
You were the only white man up there in the midst of a native population, and there were some people who didn't accept you.
Yeah. You know, I know what racism is. It's not nice. But at the same time, I was an outsider. I understand that. And so I tried to be sensitive to their feelings. I had a lot of good friends up there too, but you know, white guys didn't treat natives so good either. There's reasons to be anti-white in lots of places.
You had a run-in with your mentor while you were up there, a guy named Atla, who, again, reading from your book, he looked you in the eye and said, you know, it would be easy to kill a man. And you began carrying your rifle with you by yourself, watching your fish wheel, and you wrote later, Atla had been right. It would be easy to kill a man.
Well, you know, we got on the outs there, and he was trying to force me off the river, and I didn't want to go. You know, I mean, you're not going to push me off. And so it's not that I'm that brave. It's just that I don't know how to back down. And so he had taken a pot shot at another fisherman, and so I thought he might be going to do the same thing to me, and so I started carrying my rifle just in case.
How did the books of Jack London, books like Call of the Wild and White Fang, how did that influence you?
Well, that's a kid's dream. At least that was a lot of us kids in the country, you know, to be in the wilderness and have a trap line team. And, you know, that's just a fantasy, you know, and I got to live some of that, actually.
There was a time, and again, you write in your book so eloquently, I don't have the passage in front of me, where you were by yourself in the wilderness when your brother died, when Larry died, and you sat up on the top of a rock and you heard this lonely timber wolf howling below.
Yeah, that moment was like that wolf was sent to help me more, you know, and myself and that timber wolf, we were a lot alike that night. We needed wild places to live in. We needed wild places to hunt in. The farther from civilization, the better, where we wouldn't be interfered with anybody that wasn't of our clan. And, you know, it was just like he was sent to help me mourn that night. And I couldn't have been in a better spot. You know, I just needed to cry, and I did.
You lost your mother at the age of 18 to cancer. And she noticed a lump many months before, told your dad about it, but she never got any medical care.
Well, people couldn't afford that, you know. I mean, in those days, well, it would have bankrupted the family, I suppose. But, you know, people, that's just how it was.
So you kids never saw doctors on a regular basis?
No. You had to be hurting awful bad to get carted off to see a doctor.
You think that's still true with a lot of rural families in northern Wisconsin?
I don't know. I don't know with our social network anymore, a safety net. It shouldn't be. You know, I hope it's not. For kids to have to suffer through toothaches like I did, man, that's miserable. What for?
You know? And they just pack aspirin in the,
that's what
in
Mom
the cavity.
Did. Yep.
Let's. We got time to squeeze in one more call. Let's go to Jeff in Jump River. Jeff, you're on Route 51 with Gary Ettinger. Hello, Jeff.
Route 51 and Gary. How are you?
We're doing fine. Jeff, you got to make it quick. We're running out of time for the radio show.
You know, Gary, in your book, you talk about wanting to pass your miracle along to a woman that you met. I want to hear your feelings about exactly why you wanted to do that.
Well, there was a woman in the hospital there. She was next to me, and she just lived north of Phillips. And she was just an angel. I mean, I went into her room that afternoon, and just goodness came out of this gal. And I don't know. I just wanted her to live. I wanted her to heal. She was such a good person. And I didn't need my miracle anymore, so I tried to give it to her. But it didn't work.
Well, that's too bad. But thank you for trying. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks so much. Thanks so much for the phone call. Gary, you don't drink, you don't smoke, you never have during your life?
No.
How do you manage to avoid that when drinking and smoking are kind of the state pastimes in northern Wisconsin?
Because I've seen what it did to my family and those around me, and none of it was any good.
And the doctors credited your abstinence, your non-drinking, your non-smoking, your healthy living with helping you survive that terrible February 15th 2 years ago.
Oh, for sure. You know, the little bit of blood I had left in me, it must have had some good circulation to keep getting there and keeping me alive.
Gary, can you read one more section for us? And we're running out of time, so...
Okay. At the end, I write, I've known the love of a good woman and the pride of having two great kids. I felt the closest of an extensive family and a few very special friends. I felt the bat making solid contact with the ball in a championship game, the exhilarating feeling of a world-class dog team, and the heart-pounding excitement of aiming at a big game animal just before I pulled the trigger. I've known the special taste of homemade ice cream on my birthday and experienced the warm Christmases that only a house full of kids can have. I've also known the joy of learning in a one-room country school. I floated in my imagination with northern lights too glorious to describe across a high Arctic sky. I've known the beauty of paddling across the wild Canadian lake under a full moon and of drifting down the Yukon under the twilight of the midnight sun. I've listened to the soft whisper of my river as fireflies twinkle to the call of a whippoorwill floating across our field on a warm summer's night. I've heard the tinkle of my lead mare's bell in a high mountain meadow on a cool summer's evening. I've listened to the magical sound of a wild bull elk's bugle as I pull the pack string on a frosty mountain morning. I've sucked in that wonderful breath of life-giving air after being under the water too long, and I've witnessed a sunrise I thought I would never see again. Who could ask for more?
Gary Ettinger, you write like an angel. You really do.
Thank you.
And I don't know how you learned to do it, but you've been blessed. That book of yours, where can people pick it up?
Well, the easiest way is just go on GaryEttinger.com and email me, and I'll steer you. You know, if you want an autographed copy, I'll be happy to send you one.
All right. Gary Ettinger, the author of Will to Live, A Saga of Survival. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Next Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, Route 51 takes the day off. We'll be back the following Thursday, December 2nd, with a program on the importance of philanthropy. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network stations, WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau and 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, WHAA 89.1 FM Adams, Wisconsin Rapids, and WHRM 90.9 FM High Definition Channel 3, Wausau. A reminder, you can follow our adventures on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Until next time, we're heading out of town.